Why are you here? I've been doing some reading in my off time. As you will know, my job, and we're looking to move over to Japan soon. It's left me with a lot of off time sitting around the house, which is really weird for me. I'm used to just working 40 hours a week. So it's weird. I mean, it was wonderful for the first couple of weeks, but after that you start getting bored, you start getting a little stir crazy. I found myself reading books and studying things that I'd never had much of an interest in. And actually started some from some fiction books that came up with some interesting theories that I decided to do some reading about, and then Chris and I ended up having a discussion on these things for hours and hours to the dismay of Becky and Mary Lee. But one of the things I came across was this idea of quantum mechanics and quantum physics, and I am in no way, shape, or form anywhere close to being an expert on this stuff. It's just, I read an interesting theory in a fiction book, and I looked up into it a little bit, and it was very intriguing. There's this whole idea of light and energy and what form it can take, because it can be dots or it can be waves. And as we know, like sound is, you know, it moves in waves and things like that. So this theory was, does light and does pure energy move as dots or as waves? And the theory that brought up was the fact that it actually is what they consider pure potential, because it could actually be either or. And they figured this out simply by the act of measuring it. Now, believe me, I don't understand exactly how this all works. But they were finding out that whether they were just measuring the energy, it would sometimes be dots and it would sometimes be waves. And so then the fiction book took off on its own fictional story on how exactly this could apply today. I just thought it was so amazing that here science and so many people around the world were devoting themselves to working on this level of life. I mean, you're looking at something that is so far below even atoms. You're looking at what makes up atoms. What are the ultimately basic building blocks and protons of the world? And they're trying to build, to break those down and find out, well, what exactly makes those things work? And the point is, they're trying to figure out exactly how does the universe work at its very basic level. In Switzerland, there's a thing called a Large Hadron Collider. And what this thing is it's some kind of machine, I guess you'd call it. And what they do is they send protons around a 17-mile loop at nearly the speed of light, in which at the other end of the loop they would collide with each other. Now what they're hoping for is that when these protons collide and crash, they would be able to see exactly what they're made up of. So this is beyond the idea of even splitting an atom. They're now getting down to the idea of protons. They have to send them around, I mean, imagine a 17-mile loop at nearly the speed of light to get these things to crash and so they can see exactly what they're made of. And there's all sorts of theories and ideas of what they think they'll see, what they hope they'll see, as well as the possibility that they may not see anything. It's a big, and it turned out to be a big failure. And what they can call to be the most expensive and most amazing experiment in the history of man is what they're, you know, these people are looking at it. So they're trying to figure out exactly how the universe works, and even on a subatomic level. What are we truly made of? What is our purpose here? Where are we going? And there's all sorts of theories, again, as to what exactly they can use this technology and knowledge for. But I started asking myself, well, what's the point? What's the real purpose? Why do we really need to know exactly how a proton works? You know, what are we really going to gain from it that God hasn't already told us? But then I also realized that the most part of the scientific community doesn't believe in the God of the Bible. They're looking for something else. They're trying to find answers that they're going to just continue grasping at straws, trying to find. So let's scale it back. The idea of what are we made of, what is our purpose, where are we going? And I'm asking the question, well, why are you here at Glennon? Why are you even here tonight? Is it because you got nothing better to do? Is it because church is just what you do? Or perhaps it's something a little deeper, something more important. Is Christianity just something we do here while we go to school, get married, have babies, work? Is Christianity just another one of the things that we do? Or is Christianity what life is all about? And we just go to school, work, get married, and have babies while we're here. It's pretty much doing the same thing, but you're flipping your attention, your focus, your attitude. Is your focus and your attitude on working, on going to school, on getting married, on raising babies, and Christianity is just something you do? Or is your focus and your attention on Christianity, and yet while you're here, you got to go to school, you got to go to work, you get married, you have a family? Matthew chapter 13 is a parable that I think all of us have probably heard. We've been around the church for a little while. The parable is in chapter 13, verses 1 through 8. On that day, Jesus went out of the house and was sitting by the sea, and great multitudes gathered to him, so that he got into a boat and sat down, and the whole multitude was standing on the beach. And he spoke many things to them in parables, saying, "Behold, the sower went out to sow. And as he sowed, some of the seeds fell beside the road, and the birds came and ate them up. And others fell upon the rocky places where they did not have much soil. And immediately they sprang up because they had no depth of soil. But when the sun had risen, they were scorched, and because they had no root, they withered away. And others fell among the thorns, and the thorns came up and choked them out. And others fell on the good soil and yielded a crop, some 100-fold, some 60, and some 30. He who has ears, let him hear." Now, do you guys know what the explanation of this parable is? I, for one, can say I know that I've probably heard countless number of sermons and lessons on this very parable. So what do the birds stand for in the parable? What's that? Satan. The explanation starts in verse 18. But yes, it says that the bird is the evil one. The evil one comes and snatches away what has been sown in his heart. And this is the one on whom the seed was sown beside the road. For a lot of people that come through the church, they hear the seed, or maybe they heard it from someone they met somewhere at work or at school. But it never took root, it never went anywhere. They just let that seed sit there and they never really thought about it. And the evil one came by quickly and snatched it up. What about the rocks? What does the rock stand for? Anybody? Can you grow? Can you grow seeds in rocks? No? What's that? Well, yeah, I can stand for trouble too. How about just the fact that the rocky soil, there was no depth there. There was nothing there for the seed to take root. It says that, "And the one on whom seed was sown on the rocky places, this is the man who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy, yet he has no firm root in himself, but is only temporary. And when affliction or persecution arises because of the world, immediately he falls away." How many lost trees during the last storm? Or at least saw trees lost. How many lost power for days? We had a tree in our apartments, and this was not a small tree. I mean, it was one of these trees. And it was right in between the end of the parking lot and then about 4 feet of dirt before one of the actual buildings. It's not really a good place to put a big, huge tree, because you've got a building with foundations on one side and you've got concrete on the other side. There's not a whole lot of really good deep soil for that tree to grow roots. Well, I went out just to take the garbage out and decided to go get the mail. I mean, I have a fascination with storms, which some people might call stupid. and I got in trouble for going out that night. But I thought the wind was cool. I thought the rain was cool. I put my jacket on. I figured I'd go take the garbage out and go walk down and get the net. Well, I came out, and I saw this tree leaning at a 45-degree angle and starting to hit the building. And so I called our apartment emergency line, and the guy was basically like, well, there's nothing we can do until it falls. So I figured I at least needed to tell someone. Also, there's cars parked right there, so why wouldn't, I mean, this is about 12:30 in the morning. And I started banging on doors, trying to find people whose cars might be right there in case it fell down. And it did fall down. And some of the branches landed on my cars. I don't think there's any major damage, but there was tons of trees all over the place. That happens when the soil that those trees are in are not strong enough to stand against the storms that come against them. Now, there's oak trees. Oak trees are a different matter. I've heard that oak trees can have root systems that even go up to miles long and miles deep. But then you get these trees that just have no root and they have no soil. The storm's going to come and they're going to fall. So what about the thorns? What do the thorns stand for in this parable?
The worries of life.
What's that?
The worries of life.
The worries of life. What do thorns do to good plants? They choke them out. So the worries of life are what chokes out. Verse 22 says, and the one on whom the seed was sown among the thorns, this is the man who hears the word, and the worry of the world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and it becomes unfruitful. And then we have the good soil. And the one on whom seed was sown on the good soil, this is the man who hears the word and understands it, who indeed bears fruit and brings forth some 100-fold, some 60, and some 30. But the thorns is what I'm concentrating on tonight. It says that the cares and the worries of the world are related to thorns. Thorns that choke our life. Now, as we talked about the questions in the beginning, where is our focus and our attention? Is our focus and our attention spent only on the worries of the world? We spend all of our lives worrying about our jobs, worrying about where we live, our cars, worrying about school if you're going to school, worrying about whether or not you're going to be able to get married, worrying about when you are married, how you're going to live with each other. You know, you have your ups and downs. Having babies, worrying about having babies. These are the thorns. When we allow those thorns to come up and choke our faith, then we're no different than that parable. When our focus and our attention is spent so much on those things, and Christianity is nothing more than just one of the things we do, then those thorns will eventually choke us. So how many of us here have worried about those things? Worried about work. Worried about babies. Worried about moving. Worried about school. Well, it's interesting because in a matter of just a few months, Marilee and I, well, I quit my job. We had a baby. We decided to move and go back to school. There's a lot to worry about. It's weird for me. It doesn't feel right to not be working, to not be doing something all day long. Guys, many times I get this feeling like I'm missing something. I'm not doing something. You know, you have this nagging feeling in the back of my head like something's not right because I'm not doing anything. You know, I'm sitting around reading dumb stuff about quantum mechanics. We also got insurance to worry about. Sometimes I wondered if it was a good idea to quit my job before we had the baby. But there is COBRA, and you got these COBRA things and these papers to fill out. And I'm also worried about math. So I got to go back to school and do math. That worries me. So do we make our earthly lives, our daily focus and attention and worries, and our faith in God is just another part of it, or sometimes even a smaller part? Now in Genesis 3, that is where the fall of man. And God basically tells Adam what's going to happen. He says, by the sweat of your brow, you're going to eat. You're going to have to toil in the land. In 1 Thessalonians 4:11 and 12, If I quote it, I'll probably get it wrong too. Says, and to make it your ambition to lead a quiet life and attend to your own business and work with your hands just as we commanded you, so that you may behave properly toward outsiders and not be in any need. So on one hand, it is given to us by God that we need to work, man in particular. We need to be working, we need to be toiling, we need to be sweating. That's how we get the food we eat. That's how our society is based. We work. We earn money, and then we go buy the things that we need. And in this passage too, it says, make it your ambition to lead a quiet life, attend to your business, and work with your hands. So yes, it is good for us to work. It is important for us to work. You know, when we see a person who is not taking his responsibility, who is loafing around life, it doesn't look good. We tend to kind of look down on that person. It's important to, you know, particularly for a man, the way God has set it up, to be working. To be earning his way, to be earning his keep in a sense, you know. Many times working means going to school. And sometimes you got to go to school to get the job you're looking for. You know, I never thought I'd end up being in Iowa. But when I'm looking at the chiropractor schools where I want to be, it looks like we might eventually end up in Iowa. You know, I never knew exactly where God was going to lead. You know, going from job to job to job to now going back to school. But this is important to do. However, Colossians chapter 3. Colossians chapter 3 verses 23 to 24 says, whatever you do, do your work heartily as for the Lord rather than for men. Knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance, it is the Lord Christ whom you serve. So yes, it is important for us to work. And if we're not working, we're not taking care of ourselves and our families, there's something to be worried about. It is a concern to not be loafing around, but to be working and doing something. However, our focus and our attention should not be on our jobs as being more important than our faith, than God. We rather should be focusing on God. In fact, it even says here, as you're working, you should be working as if you're working for God. So even in your job, you're serving God. You're pleasing God, not the other way around. Not that you go to work, you do your thing, and then on Sunday you go to church and you do your church thing. I went to church in Spokane, and I met someone who had gone to church, and one of the elders there, who he saw on the job, I think he was a foreman. And he was on a construction job, and he heard this foreman cursing and telling crude jokes, who happened to be one of the elders of the church. And when he approached him about it, the elder's response was this: when I go to work, I'm at work. On Sunday, when I go to church, then I'm at church. He was separating those two things. Work was work, and church was church. Work is something he did where he went, and he obviously felt it was important or necessary or just who he was to look just like he is part of the rest of the world. And then on Sunday, then he can go to church and do it. That's not what it says here in Colossians. It says even when you do your work, work as if you're working for God. There's the Lord God you serve. Is it good to marry and have babies? Well, I sure hope so, because otherwise I'm having a bad year. Is it important to be worried about your child? I think it's natural. You see, you can ask Marilee, there's all these weird fears and paranoias that come over you when you have a little baby. Things that you never even thought about. You know, suddenly you're worried about, is his hands too cold? Is he too hot? You know, what does this cry mean? What does this cough mean? What does this mean? You start thinking down the road. How are you going to raise him? How are you going to take care of him? How are you going to protect him from getting hurt? And it's amazing all the different things that come over you. And yet, it's important though, because you're the parent. It is your job to raise that child. But do you let that worry take the place of your faith in God? That's another question. I think some people do. I've known people who lift their children even up above their own spouse. People I've been very close to had a situation like that. where as soon as they started having kids, their relationship basically went like this. Stayed together for many years, but the wife treated the children as if they were the single most important thing in her life, over God and over her spouse, and it went that way. And the man, he basically treated his job as if that was more important. His duty was to work, her duty was to raise the children, and that was it. It was no surprise it ended in divorce. And it's no surprise the children don't have a great relationship with their dad. That's what happens when you start putting your priorities all out of place. Matthew chapter 10, verse 32. This is not one of the prettiest verses in the Bible. Matthew chapter 10, verse 32. Everyone, therefore, who shall confess me before men, I will also confess him before my Father in heaven. But whoever shall deny me before men, I will also deny him before my Father who is in heaven. Do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I came to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's enemies will be the members of his household. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. He who has found his life shall lose it, and he who has lost his life for my sake shall find it. It can be a very difficult verse for us to grasp. As humans, we're naturally drawn to humans. In families, we're naturally drawn to lift our own families as being the strongest bonds we have in this life. And then Christ comes and tells us that if you love your father, your mother, your daughter, your son more than him, he says you're not worthy of him. And yet how many people lift their families as being more important than God? Since the year 2000, I've lost 3 grandparents and my dad. But yet I gained a wife and a baby. It's an emotional tornado. And the 2000s have been. It hurt really bad to lose my father. And yet it's beyond amazing to get married and have a child. Yet Christ says not to love anyone more than him. It's tough for us to lose someone you love. Someone so close to you. And yet when you gain a wife and a child and you start having these feelings of great love and care for someone, it fills your life so much. And yet the perspective that Christ wants us to have is understanding he comes first. And that's difficult for us to do. We're just naturally drawn to want to love our families and hold those human bonds that we have here. But yet another human does not have the ability to save your soul. You do not even have the ability to save your own soul. That comes from Christ and from Christ alone. Now it is the second greatest commandment for us to love our neighbor and love each other as we love ourselves. We are to love our families. We are to love even the sinners and try to help them and save them. But we cannot love them more than we love Christ. For we've set earthly things ahead of him. And it's not by earthly things that we love. I have no idea where we are on time. I better skip ahead a little bit. In Philippians 3, 1 through 14, I won't read the whole thing. But Paul says something very striking. He just goes about basically bragging about who he was, where how he was raised, the kind of person he was, and yet he ends it all and says that he counts it all as loss. He counts it all as rubbish for the sake of being in Christ. And Chris and I were talking, and I think, didn't that original translation mean refuse? Is that right? Dumb? Refuse? Paul is actually relating all of these earthly things that he had the right to brag about as being nothing more than refuse for the sake of gaining Christ. don't know if any of you know of the MTV show called Cribs. For a long time, this was one of my favorite TV shows. This show was about going into celebrities and sports people's homes and basically just showing their homes. And these are some of the most amazing homes you'll ever see. Shaquille O'Neal had his own separate cigar room. Now, he also had a walk-in humidor for his cigars and then a separate room to actually smoke them. And I thought, well, how neat is it, I guess, in that sense, that you have enough money and ability that you can set aside separate rooms simply for smoking cigars. One room to hold the cigars, one room to smoke them. That you can just afford to have different rooms for whatever your pleasures and desires might be. You know, and here we are trying to duke it out in, you know, in a little two-bedroom, one bath. You know, it's one of us is going to the bathroom and doing things, well, you just got to wait. You know, there's two rooms just isn't enough to hold all the things that we have, let alone thinking that I could have a room just to put cigars in, you know. I had a chance to work at Paul Allen's house, or at least house number one. He's got a house, or I should say a building that was three times the size of the house I grew up in, and that's just for the cigars. Then he's got a separate house that has a huge pool that's got a two-story diving board. It's got a big, huge, I mean, amazingly huge Chihuly glass chandelier above the hot tub. He's got a basketball court, tennis courts. You know, but then down farther down the hill, well, then there's the actual main house. And it's just incredible. Marilee and I love to sit and dream about the home we eventually would like to have. We read the magazines, home magazines, kitchen and bath design magazines. We'd love to have acreage. We'd love to have an extra cabin as well. Racquetball court, pool, hot tub, huge master bath, a game room, office, project room, garage, all these different things. And yet we could also ask the members of this own church, what are the troubles of building one house? Now, I have friends who tried, coworkers who tried building. And it's been a 3-4 year process. And I also asked myself, well, if I had that ultimate kind of money, is that really how I'd want to spend it, though? You know, it just seems like it would be so selfish and vain to have that kind of money and all you can think about is how you can try to make your home more comfortable for you. Let's turn to Romans chapter 8. I'll try to skip through a few more verses and get to the ultimate point. But Romans chapter 8, starting at verse 19. For the anxious longing of the creation waits eagerly for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but because of him who subjected it in hope, that the creation itself also will be set free from its slavery to corruption into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth together until now. And not only this, but also we ourselves, having the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting eagerly for our adoption as sons, the redemption of our body. For in hope we have been saved, but hope that is seen is not hope. For why does one also hope for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, with perseverance we wait eagerly for it. Is that the attitude of someone whose sole focus and attention and hopes are on building things for himself in this life? It sounds like we ourselves should be feeling groans and pains, eagerly waiting for heaven. That means our desire, our whole desire here on earth, is that we don't want to be here. We want to be up there in heaven with God. Yet while we're here, we got to do some things. We got to go to school. We got to work. We got to take care of our families. But yet the whole time we're doing this, we're groaning within ourselves. We're waiting for heaven. We're eagerly waiting for the redemption of our bodies. This world is not our home. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 1 through 9. For we know that if the earthly tent, which is our house, is torn down, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For indeed in this house we groan, longing to be clothed with our dwelling from heaven, inasmuch as we, having put it on, shall not be found naked. For indeed, while we are in this tent, we groan, being burdened, because we do not want to be unclothed, but to be clothed, in order that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life. Now he who prepared us for this very purpose is God, who gave to us the Spirit as a pledge. Therefore, being always of good courage, and knowing that while we are at home in the body, we are absent from the Lord. So we walk by faith, not by sight. We are of good courage, I say, and prefer rather to be absent from the body and to be at home with the Lord. Therefore also we have as our ambition, whether at home or absent, to be pleasing to Him. Basically what He's telling us is that while we are here in this body, we are essentially unclothed. It is essentially as if we are naked. And what we are groaning for is to be clothed with our heavenly tents. To be clothed and to be living in the eternal house that God has for us. So how many times do we spend our groans for the things of this world? We spend our eager anticipation, our groanings, our efforts, our striving, everything we put forth simply to attain and to achieve things in this life, and Christianity is just something we do along the way. As opposed to our eager anticipation, our striving, our ambition, our groanings, is to be pleasing to God, is to eventually be in heaven. And along the way, there's things we must do. There's a difference in attitude. So ask again, why are you here? Do you come here to be pleasing to God from your heart, mind, body, and soul? We'll run through these real quick. How do we please Him? Galatians 2:20, Paul says, it is no longer him who lives, but Christ who lives in him. He has been crucified with Christ. If you could stop for just a second and think about what that means, and if you ask yourself, have I died? Is it no longer you who live, but Christ who lives in you? Would your life be any different if you truly believed in that it was Christ living in you? As opposed to you living your life? Colossians 3:1-4. This is one of my personal favorites. It says, if then you have been raised up with Christ, keep seeking the things above where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on the things above, not on the things that are on earth. For you have died and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, is revealed, then you also will be revealed with Him in glory. Do we live as if we, our selfish beings, have died? And it is Christ who lives in us. We are setting our minds on the things above, not on the things that are on earth. There's a few more, Ephesians 5:15-17. But also we're going to skip ahead. Philippians 4:4-10. We know what that says. It says, be anxious for nothing, but in everything let your requests be made known to God. It says, whatever is honorable and true and lovely. It goes on to say, Paul says that he is comfortable whether he has great means or whether he's in poverty. That doesn't matter to him, because he knows that he can do all things through Christ who gives him strength. It is an attitude of not being worried, not being concerned, not letting the cares of this world choke us out, because he knows that by prayer and by faith and by trusting God, anything is possible. So again, why are you here? 2 Corinthians 5, the last verses 6-9, says it is our ambition to be pleasing to him. To please God in all that we do while we go to school, work, and get married and have kids and go to church, it's all to please our God and Savior. Thank you.